Right, going to be speaking to Chris Sutton, former Norwich City, Blackburn Rovers, Chelsea, Celtic, Birmingham City, Aston Villa. List goes on. And, of course, English capped as well, international. And he's got a brand new book out. Good afternoon to you, Chris. How are you?
Good afternoon. Very, very well. Thank you for having me on, Dave.
It's great to have you on, Chris. It really is. Before we get on to the book, can we just talk a little bit about your career? Is that all right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I love talking about myself.
slight delay here on the Skype, but I think we can get on with that. So you start off, is it Norwich City, your first port of call?
Yes, yeah, I was actually rejected by Norwich City as a lanky 12-year-old, and they deemed me not good enough. But I worked hard through my teenage years, got another opportunity when I was 16 to go down on trial, and within a couple of years I was in the first team, fortunately for me, and I never looked back. I was part of a really good Norwich City team, a lot of older players, the likes of Rule Fox and Ian Crook.
Yeah.
Who really helped me develop and taught me a lot. So it was a really good starting point for me.
Was it difficult getting over that initial rejection, you know, when somebody says, you know what, not what we're looking for?
I don't think anybody likes being being rejected. And being so young as well, 12 years old at that particular time, I naturally thought that my chances of becoming a professional footballer had gone. But I was lucky that I had my dad, who was a huge, huge influence on me, who played professional football himself at a lower level, but Carlisle, Chester, and Norwich City as well, who really stressed the importance of fitness and working hard and repetition. And it was those teenage years, really, where I honed my skills and put in the hard yards. And when I went back to get that second opportunity, I have to say, I think the boys who had come up naturally through the schoolboy system, I felt I was in a better position mentally than them. I felt I was hungrier than them, and I didn't let that chance pass me by when I got it again.
It wasn't one of these dads then that said, you better have a trade behind you, you know, or whatever, you know, because if it all falls down, you know, at least you can be a plumber or something.
Well, there is that. Yeah. Of course, you know that I'd actually got a job at Norfolk County Council as a clerk, but then I got the opportunity to go for a trial at Norwich. So who knows where I could have been, Dave?
Yeah, brilliant. And of course, playing at Blackburn Rovers and Chelsea. I mean, when you play with these teams, I mean, they must always, I suppose, even have a place in your heart right to this moment, do they?
Absolutely. I love Norwich. It was my hometown club. But, you know, the opportunity to move to Blackburn Rovers and, of course, under Kenny Dalglish, we won the Premier League, playing up front with Alan Shearer, the greatest striker the Premier League has ever had. And great memories. 5 good years at Blackburn. I went for that was a British record transfer fee at the time when I moved from Norwich to Blackburn Rovers, but was part of a really good, successful team at Blackburn. Then I went to Chelsea for £10 million, had a bit of a stinker there. You go for big money, you're expected to score goals as a striker. It didn't happen. Didn't happen for me there.
Yeah. So, I mean, can you relate when suddenly, you know, big money's spent and there's so much expectation on you when you're coming in, you know, especially from the fans and the club, you know, spent £10 million on you, you got to deliver.
Yeah. That's the game. You know, I work in the media now. I wish I understood the game a bit better back then. I was a big baby. When I was at Norwich, I used to buy all the newspapers. I liked my name. You know, everything was positive. I liked the headlines. Then, actually, when I moved to Blackburn, the first negative press was, am I worth the £5 million? Am I worth a British record transfer fee? So there was... I had to prove myself. I did it at Blackburn, but then moved again for big money to Chelsea, and I was poor. I don't blame anybody else for that. That was, you know, that was down to me. It wasn't because of the system Chelsea played. It was purely down to me. And you have to accept the criticism. I don't think anybody likes criticism, but you have to get on with it. And I'd signed a 6-year deal at Chelsea for, you know, I was on a lot of money there. But and then within 12 months, it had all fallen apart, and I'd resurrected my career at Celtic. And in many respects, when I went up to Scotland and Celtic, I really appreciated what I had again, because in the early days when I was playing at Norwich and Blackburn, everything was on an upward trajectory. I'd never really had a bad time in my career. So it was the time at Chelsea where I really started to think about how lucky I was to be a professional footballer when I got back at Celtic, and really took everything in, really embraced every day when I went into training and appreciated what I had.
It comes across, as I'm listening to you now, Chris, your love for the game. I mean, you just love football. But when you were at Chelsea, you're aware, you've proven yourself. I'm a good player. I can play well. I've proven it at Norwich. And yet the dynamics, whatever it may be, the style of play, just isn't happening for you. Do insecurities come in at that moment thinking, you know, have I lost it? Am I not the player I once was?
Mm. Yeah, I think that certainly Chelsea was a big lesson for me. I think that I lost confidence, and everybody has to deal with a dip in form in different ways. Yeah. I always used to get confidence from training. Repetition was really important to me. What I learned when I was younger. But Chelsea really did affect me, and I was on my knees there. As I said, I was a laughingstock, ridiculed in the national press. But that's a brutal game, football, and you have to come through it. And fortunately, I think in the end, strength of character and building myself back up, I was lucky at Celtic that I went in under Martin O'Neill, who was a hugely successful manager. At Celtic, and had been a successful manager at Leicester City, and was part of a Celtic team who, on our day, could match absolutely anybody across Europe.
And how many players have played for Birmingham City and Aston Villa? So I'd like to know. I'm a Derby exactly. fan, you see, and not many players. There's a few that have gone to Nottingham Forest from Derby.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I went down to Birmingham for a few months, and then moved to Aston Villa. Martin O'Neill had actually taken the job at Aston Villa, and he phoned me up, and I'd had an operation. I was thinking of retiring, and he said, "Chris, we're absolutely desperate," which made me feel really good. So I went over to Villa, but I don't think too many people notice, to be honest, Dave.
All right. Well, it's on the list anyway, so it looks good, doesn't it? Some great teams anyway. I mean, as I was saying just there, listening to you, Chris, talking, and of course, let me just mention as well, of course, getting the England cap. What's that like?
Yeah, it was a huge honour, but I have to say I had a habit throughout my career of shooting myself in the foot, and I refused to play in an England B game when Glenn Hoddle was manager, and that was the end of my England career. So I work with Glenn now, and I mean nobody has the right to do what I did at that particular time, and I do look back, and there are people who say no regrets, but I can tell you I'm not one of those. I look back on my career and my life, I've got plenty, dozens of regrets, and that was certainly one of them, but proud to represent my country.
Yeah, but it takes a big person to say, you know what, I made a mistake there, or I just wasn't the right decision, and it's easy to look back and say that, of course.
It wasn't just one mistake. It was numerous mistakes. I was always very hot-headed, I think, and now I'm a little bit older. I think I've mellowed. I don't know what other people think. But I was always impulsive. I think I was pretty fair. I wasn't happy at the time because when I did get my England cap, I felt I was playing pretty well. There were always players in front of me, the likes of Alan Shearer and Teddy Sheringham, and I was aware of that. I just felt at that particular time when my form was good, I deserved an opportunity. Having said all that, nobody deserves or nobody has the right to speak to an England manager, in which I did, and quite rightly, Glenn binned me.
Yeah, well, nonetheless, it's a you've got a great career behind you, and actually great career at the moment as well, because you're working in the media as well, aren't you, with football and likes of BT Sport and Five Live and so on. And you mentioned Alan Shearer there, but I think you're a better pundit. Would you say or not? Don't answer that.
I'm not sure about that. Alan gets the massive gigs, and there's a reason for that.
He's
very good.
I'm only joking, of course.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, like you say, that you've been with football throughout most of your life, from very early age. You've seen all aspects of the game, and really, the book does talk about this, doesn't it? The good, the bad, and the ugly. Why do you feel the need to write this book? And because as many of us football fans, I think we're all behind you, saying, you know, yes, there's definitely massive room for improvement in the game.
Yeah, I think you know, first and foremost, I'm lucky. The job which I do in the media, I do the football phone in 6:06 on Five Live on a Saturday evening, and I love it. And I love opinions. I love different opinions, and listening them, and listening to other people, and taking other opinions in. Yeah. I thought I'd write this book. It's a game I love, but just on issues which there are with the game, and you know, it's a wide variety of subjects, and the difference with this book, and look, I mean, you can view me as a middle-aged man having a bit of a crisis. I get that, and there's a bit of ranting and raving in it, but there are cures for all the issues. And I mean, the first chapter is about divers. You watched the Champions League final last night, and Neymar was still up to his old tricks of rolling around.
Yeah.
And it's been a massive problem in the Premier League. When VAR came in, I thought it would clear diving up. That hasn't been the case. It, you know, it's got worse, and I think that it's an issue which really needs to be highlighted. And there needs to be a stronger punishments for divers, and we need it stamping out of the game.
It's really weird because, again, I've got to say this without kind of sounding typically British living in Spain here, but I used to kind of play a bit of football just, you know, for a hobby, and we play some Spanish teams, and I was like in my late 30s at this point, and these are like kids playing, but they're all rolling around on the floor. You're not even touch them, and they're rolling around on the floor, you know, getting an Oscar or whatever, and it's so much part of their culture from a very early age. It's such a massive thing to deal with.
Yeah, of course. I think that, you know, when I played, we used to play foreign teams, and the same thing happened. They'd go down, and they would the foreign teams would get an advantage from diving, i.e. free kicks awarded, you know, in some cases penalties. And I do think that the English teams or the British teams thought, well, you know, we might as well start joining in with this. And it's a massive problem, I think. Diving all across the world with regards to football. I watch European leagues, but, you know, the Premier League at this moment in time, it's an enormous issue and something which needs stamping out. And with the fact that VAR came in, I thought everyone thought, you know, this is going to be the end of it, but far from it. In many ways, it's got worse. So we need to properly punish the divers.
You deal with VAR, don't you, VAR, in the book as well? Because it just felt to me, this is my opinion, that it came in kind of like almost like there was a bit of a test, and they were testing it out on the Premier League, the greatest league in the world. And it doesn't feel like the finished article.
No, it's not. There's been so many high profile mistakes, isn't there, this last season? I mean, it's been horrible. I think that the Stockley Park base, which, you know, support the referees, have backed the referees blindly this last season. And it's an issue. They haven't done themselves any favours, and it needs sorting out, or it needs binning. I don't think you'd find many people who have been impressed with VAR at all.
No.
You know, this last season. It needs to improve.
Yeah, it really does. Just had a message in from, I think somebody called Jack Walker, saying, I know Chris from a pub called The Bonnie. He gave me two tickets for free for the match for Blackburn. So he got a friend there listening in as well, Chris. Again, I mean, a lot of these things have been brewing for years, you know, the kind of the wage packets and so on, of what footballers are being paid now. And I know, just looking at the Arsenal team, players that are kind of not even playing but are sitting there just raking money in out of the club. Is that something that really kind of affects you as well?
I mean, my view on players and earning the high wages, if clubs... if they can get the money and clubs are willing to pay people a high wage, then, you know, nobody's going to turn that down. The issue, there's a chapter on mercenary players.
Yeah.
And you know, my view on mercenary players, it's not a problem if you want to go and play your football in China and earn the big bucks. But it's like Marko Arnautovic went out there, didn't he, and said that he wanted to go to China to win trophies. I mean, who's he kidding? I mean, he's kidding himself if he thinks people are actually going to believe that. Just say you want to go to China and you want to earn the big bucks. That's absolutely fine. Don't tell lies.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to go to wherever and earn the big bucks, nobody has a problem with that. So no, that's a... dealt with that absolutely, chapter pretty well. But there are other chapters that... Some of the chapters and some of the solutions are pretty much tongue-in-cheek. There's a chapter on banning coloured boots, and that chapter is more about for kids to earn the right to play sport at a high level. I mean, you know, you're in a situation where there are boots, there are gloves, you've got snoods, you've got wristbands. I mean, players have got tattoos now. They're worried about the hair, what color it is, and it all being in place, and by the time they've thought about all these things, they've forgotten who they're picking up from the corner.
Yeah.
So therefore it's about concentrating on the job in hand, really, and knuckling down. So there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek solutions. It's a bit of light and shade. It's not all serious, but there are some serious topics.
I think as football fans, Chris, as I'm listening to you there, and you pretty kind of like, this is what I think, and we actually really respond well to that. I mean, you know, you just look at what Roy Keane's YouTube views are of people, you know, when he speaks quite openly about something he disagrees with. People kind of, even if they disagree with you, kind of like the fact that you're speaking your mind.
Yeah, I mean, Roy Keane is absolutely box office, isn't he? And but that's, you know, that's why, you know, I enjoy the phone in which I do, because people phone in, they talk from the heart. We don't always have to agree with everybody's view, but people back it up, and that's what, you know, that's what we love. You know, the pubs are back open here and whatever. People like to go to social clubs after games, and that's what supporting a football team is all about. And I get the diehards, the ones who have supported their club for, you know, all their lives and back the club blindly at times. But, you know, you also get the element of fans who will criticise their own club, and it's just good to hear all different sorts of opinions.
Well, I think the thing is, after you've lost a match that day, you know, and you want to go and get on the phone in, whether it be with Five Live or your local radio station or whatever it may be, when I watch Derby and have lost, I think I'm thinking, right, Cocu's got to go, Rooney's got to go, you know, but actually, you know, in the cold light of day, you think, you know, you change your opinion on it, because it is a passionate thing, isn't it? That's why we do this.
Well, that's why it's the greatest sport in the world, and that and everything, and I think it's getting worse now with social media and all the different platforms that people can communicate with now, that everything is so extreme, isn't it now? Yeah. Views are so extreme, everything is triumph or disaster or black and white, and the truth is it's probably somewhere in between.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, there's got to be a whole load of teams that don't win anything each year. That's for sure. That's just the way it is. Finally, Chris, go on. Sorry.
You make a very good point there. You know, there are so many big clubs and expectations in the Premier League, aren't they? You know, you have the big six clubs. There's only one who can win the Premier League. There's only one who can win the FA Cup, one who can win the League Cup. So, and if they don't win, you know, the other big teams, then it's an absolute disaster, isn't it? Sack the manager, sack the players, sack everybody, and that's the way things have used.
Just finally, Chris, on managers, you do talk about managers and talk about bland kind of press conferences and post-match interviews and so on in the book. Tell us your views on that.
I mean, there's a chapter on, making post-match interviews more interesting because, I mean, how many times do you see a good interview from a manager? Managers play a straight bat all the time. We had Arsene Wenger for 20 years saying he didn't see an incident when he, you know, clearly did. He's in, you know, had a better vantage point than everybody else in the ground. And you know, it's an issue. You know, it's a game of two halves. Yeah. The lad's done well and all that. Nobody's interested. You want to hear authentic. You know what the managers really think. I was lucky enough to, you know, to play professional football and be in the dressing rooms, and you want to hear the unvarnished truth. So there's an interesting solution to that, which is slightly tongue-in-cheek, but one that was one of the chapters I really enjoyed writing. And just the final chapter of the book, I have to say, is probably my favourite chapter, and that's called Play the Game or Lose It Forever. And that's about the issue of technology and the danger of technology. I don't know what it's like in Spain, but I live in a near Norwich, and if I go into Norwich city centre and you see kids or you see people walking around, you see their heads down, they're all looking at the smartphones. Yeah. And there's been a population increase in this country, but there's been a participation in sport, a decrease in that, and it's a huge problem because of technology. There are a lot of good things about smartphones and technology and communicating, but there's a lot of bad things as well. And football clubs in this country certainly are disbanding, leagues are dying out, and it's an issue which certainly needs sorting. I've got kids who drive me nuts. They play PlayStation. I say, if you want to play sports or high level, you need to get out in the park and play football. Repetition, repetition, repetition. There is an issue with this. I mean, esports. My son told me that they're talking about getting esports in the Olympics. Well, that's absolutely madness, isn't it? I mean, you can't get an Olympic gold medal for sitting there with a joystick, twiddling your thumbs, eating crisps, you know, having a fizzy drink, eating chips and chopped fish. Yeah, it's ridiculous. The world's gone mad, hasn't it? Come on.
Chris, I was just reminded of talking about managers there. I was watching one of my favourite managers, of course, from being a Derby fan, Cluffy, when they said to him, he lost the match today. He had a good afternoon, Brian. No, I've not had a good afternoon. But to be honest, I'm going to be back home with my grandkids later on tonight, and I'll forget all about this. I thought it was just kind of a straight, honest, you know, I'm not had a great afternoon, but I'm going home, so I'll see you later.
And he was the master of interviews, wasn't he? He was so watchable after games because he said what everybody else was thinking, and that's something I think we are really missing. Let's get more Brian Clough's back into the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chris, we were meant to be chatting for 10 minutes, but me and you have just been chatting on, which is absolutely fine. The book is called, let me get all this in front of me now, You're Better Than That, How to Fix Modern Football. And I felt like we put the world to rights a little bit this afternoon, Chris, but if you really want to spend some time doing it, buy the book. It's available on our website, tre.radio. Chris Sutton, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for having me.